idea of individual intellectual property really didn't start until the 16th century. And patents, although there are very early patents, they're really privileges for trading, didn't really get started until the 18th, 19th centuries. And that's in a world of economic competition. So I think that human knowledge is a collective. And you could say that almost everything we do is derivative. And we, in this particular age, really hold up individuality as something, an individual property, intellectual property, intellect, as something of very high value. It wasn't always like that. And I think there are lessons to be learned from the time when it wasn't like that.
Pamela H. Smith is a professor of history at Columbia University and founding director of the Center for Science and Society, where she leads the Making and Knowing research project. Born and raised in a small, isolated California town, influenced by what she describes as a consistent, persistent, and gentle math teacher father and an artistic and creative mother, serendipity led her to discover her love of the history of science in Wollongong University in Australia. And it was that experience that led her to commit her life to being a historian of science. In part two, we discuss how Pamela established the Making and Knowing research project, its purpose, and we discuss the origins of her most recent launch, the Digital Critical Edition, called The Secrets of Craft and Nature in Renaissance France. Her team has painstakingly created an English translation of what might sound dry to many, but is a remarkable 16th century manuscript that contains over 900 recipes for making art objects, medical remedies, and materials for the household and workshop. We discuss the parallels to the artisan and craft movement of today and what we can learn from the artisans of this period. The Digital Critical Edition is an open source resource and is available to anyone to experiment and follow the recipes and directions. We also cover her views of education, failure, persistence, and the need to create a more evolved and sustainable economic model. I hope you enjoy, and if you do, share this extensive exploration and mind-expanding journey through the history of science with Pamela H. Smith.
I want to get to your work. And you have been leading the Making and Knowing project for some time, and it's here at Columbia. Could you discuss its genesis and explain to our listeners what it is?
Mm-hmm. The Making and Knowing project comes out of my research on craftspeople, and it strives to really examine deeply the intersections between craft making and scientific knowing. And it's one of the research clusters of the Center for Science and Society, which I founded at the same time as the Making and Knowing Project. And it's the center itself really looks at all kinds of different roles that science has in society. It tries to bring together natural scientists and people from scholars and practitioners of the humanities and social sciences. So we're really trying to bring together disciplines, bring together these siloed areas of knowledge that are, I think, quite problematic for the 21st century university. So the Making and Knowing Project does that in bringing together people from really all disciplines to study craft knowledge and to try to understand the kind of knowledge it is, how it is part of scientific knowing in the sense that experimental labs have technicians in them who need to become skilled, but also to try to understand the historical connection between craft knowledge and science, the beginnings of science, the scientific revolution. And let me just give you an example of what I mean by that.
Yeah.
The Royal Society, I mentioned before, founded in 1660 in London for the improvement of natural knowledge. It was founded by a group of people who were basically scholars, some of them civil servants, many of them at university, a few large merchants in there. So they were all people who were interested in the welfare of the nation. They drew upon several different sources, one of them being Francis Bacon, to formulate what they called a new philosophy. Now, what did that mean? They said this is going to be an active science, that is an active form of knowledge that will be positive and certain. Their model, the models at that time of positive certain knowledge were things like the exact sciences, astronomy, geometry and mathematics, but really geometry. I mean, geometry is certain because its axioms are already determined in advance. So those were their models of what certain science meant. Now, active, the active part of it meant actually engaging with nature, experiments. They had no idea what that meant. And so what was their first project as they founded the society with great fanfare and a history of the society already in 1667, which was really laying out the mission of the society? And so it was founded to great fanfare, but they really didn't have any idea what they were doing. So their very first project was to interview artisans. They called it the History of Trades Project, and they found it very difficult to interview artisans. But what they were doing in that is trying to figure out, what is this active part of knowledge? Mm. How can we make knowledge that actually produces things? How can we formulate a method of making that knowledge that we can carry out as people of a different social and intellectual level from these artisans? And that is a really direct link in, or a direct kind of factor in the scientific revolution.
So they were trying to deconstruct how artisans worked?
Yes.
And what their craft skills were?
Correct.
And to document it?
To document it and to try to draw, they thought that if they documented enough of it, they could try to draw out of it general principles.
That's really interesting, because it's not really an exact science.
No, I mean, the problem with actually engaging with matter is that it's incredibly messy. It is an emergent form of knowledge, and especially in a period when materials weren't standardized. And so the particularity of the world, which is what craftspeople are experts in, harnessing that particularity of the world, making things again and again, beautiful things and useful things again and again, is something that those early new philosophers wanted to capture, was that ability to, that skill, that ability to really play on all of those particularities of nature and create things, engage with nature to create things that are useful, beautiful, desirable.
Is it fair to say that that process whereby artisans fuse their, let's say, creative craft skills with domain experts in other areas of science and technology is just a universal ongoing process as part of human development? I mean, because I can think of examples today where artisans are pushing the boundaries of their creativity and borrowing from science and technology, whether it be use of code, and using algorithms in today's world.
I think that there is a continuum in human history or in human engagement with the world. I mean, humans live in the world, and they have always had to engage with the things of nature, with the environment, really in order to survive. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of engagement with nature, which is a very basic human capacity, I think, existed bronze making, glass making, the bronze hearth. It existed in the artisans' workshops in Italian cities. And it exists today in experimental laboratories, in natural scientific laboratories. So it has always existed. It takes different institutional forms. But it is one of the human capacities which is powerful, both good, ill, and is definitely a part of creativity when we talk about creativity today.
Because I've heard you talk about the importance of imitation in learning and knowing, and what we can imitate from the past as we make progress in the future. And obviously, Picasso said, genius steals. Is it something that we should be encouraging more people to do? I mean, I know that lots of the terms like pieces of work, whether it be in film or writing or art, it's derivative. is deemed a derogatory term. Mm. But if imitation is an important part of the building blocks of invention and creation, then why are we not encouraging more people to embrace imitation?
The idea of individual intellectual property really didn't start until the 16th century. And patents, although there are very early patents, they're really privileges for trading, didn't really get started until the 18th, 19th centuries. And that's in a world of economic competition. So
you're saying that that could be a barrier to progress?
Oh, I think it can be. Mm. I think that... I mean, it's a complicated question.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is that human knowledge is a collective. And you could say that almost everything we do is derivative. And we, in this particular age, really hold up individuality as something, an individual property, intellectual property, intellect, as something of very high value. It wasn't always like that. And I think there are lessons to be learned from the time when it wasn't like that. I mean, open source, everything was going to be, it was so promising. And then it was very quickly absorbed into proprietary forms. And that's partly about our economic system. And it's partly because the idea of the individual has become, really since the Renaissance, the power of the individual, the genius of the individual, the intellect of the individual has become such a valued concept in our society.
I've heard you talk about Bernard Palissy, and what he said could not be learned from writing and can only be learned without practice and experiencing 1,000 affiliations.
He's such an interesting character, Bernard Palissy, a 16th century potter, glass painter, surveyor. He was an artisan, trained as an artisan. He wrote, as actually many of his artisanal colleagues did at that time, partly to advertise their own skills, partly to see themselves as authors and a practitioner of the liberal arts. Unlike almost any other artisanal writer at the time, he really laid bare the intellectual challenge he was making to theory, he called it. So one of his books is a dialogue between theory and practice. And theory is trying to draw out of practice his secrets. That is, the landowner trying to draw out of the artisan, or the elite trying to draw out of the artisan his secrets. And practice says, even if I had 1,000 reams of paper, even if I wrote down everything, you still would not understand it because you haven't had the experience. You haven't had all of those failures. Mm-hmm. And so what he's saying there is that practice, that artisanal practice, is about experience, 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 fail, 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 extend your experience, do it again, try it a different way, that improvisation, that persistence, that just plain practice is what this knowledge consists in, and that you can't get it just through writing. And that's very true. No one could learn to ride a bicycle by reading about it.
I'm going to talk about your work that you're about to launch called the Digital Critical Edition. But before I do, you mentioned failure there. And you also talked about how when you were brought up at school in the curriculum of the time, that tests didn't happen. It was all about creativity. Do you think that we're doing a disservice to our children, our students, by making them fearful of failure? Even though that we live in a culture where fail fast, fail cheap, and startup culture embraces failure. But the reality is, are we creating a culture of failure?
It feels like it.
A culture of fear of failure.
Yeah.
I mean,
partly, I mean, I see it from my perspective in higher education, and the competition for places at university has become so fierce because the population of university-bound both undergraduates and graduates has increased so much, and the places in the universities have not increased over the past 30 years. So the competition is just fierce. And students are so afraid to take risks. They're so afraid of failure. And I just think that's a terrible thing. I think that the kind of freedom to explore this in school is where you have it. And if you're so concerned about failing and so early professionalized, I see it as such a loss for them.
Yeah.
And maybe a loss for all of us.
I think so. I mean, most definitely, particularly as we enter a world of artificial intelligence and the imperative to embrace our innate creativity, to encourage curiosity and to push people to places they wouldn't otherwise go.
I hope so. I hope it means...
It's our only way of humanity having a role in an AI, an increasingly AI-driven world.
Yeah, I hope that that's what AI will do. I mean, in terms of freeing us to be human. I don't know.
No, if you listen to Yuval Noah Harari's speech last week at Davos, where he talked about the increasing risk of digital dictatorships and digital colonies, it doesn't bode well for us. But we'll skip that one just now. Can you explain to our listeners what the Digital Critical Edition is and how that builds on your Making and Knowing project?
Well, we're just about to launch it. It will be, well, actually, probably by the time this podcast is published, it will be published on February 6th. I said the Making Knowing Project explores intersections between craft making and scientific knowing. And we do that through really deep focus on an object of research. And our object of research for the past 5 years has been this fascinating, remarkable collection of about 900 technical recipes for art objects and technical objects. So what I mean by that are sculpture, painting, cannon casting, all kinds of things. It's a French late 16th century anonymous text. It's now in the National Library of France, the Bibliothèque Nationale, and has been since the 17th century. It was probably finished by about 1588. Anyway, it's like Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks. It is full of observations and jottings on artisanal techniques, on daily life, on ideas for doing things, and in not so much new inventions. He's not the author practitioner, as we call the anonymous author of this text, is not thinking up a lot of new things, but really wants to write them down. Very complicated process of writing down. It's a mess of a text, but in any case, invaluable for artisanal knowledge. If you're interested in finding ways to understand the influences that the constant experimentation of the craft workshop had on the development of laboratory sciences, this is a great text for that, because you really have so little insight into craft practices through writings, right? But this is like unfiltered in some ways, which makes it hard to read. Anyway, the Digital Critical Edition is a verbatim transcription of this manuscript, an English translation, and then a entire critical commentary, explanation of what the terms are, explanation of the techniques, and it will be openly accessible online. It will, by mid-May, we hope, have more than 120 essays that explain the whole manuscript. It has all kinds of resources to really bring the artisanal workshop to life.
Sounds like someone's life. Whoever this person was, it sounds like their life work.
Yes, it's very hard to know exactly how it came into being.
And it's definitely one person.
Yes, it's one hand. It's almost only one handwriting. There's a scribe involved. There are a couple of different handwritings. Hard to know whether they're the same person or not. In any case, the interesting thing is, which just goes to show how interested people were in this kind of practical knowledge at the time, late 16th century, is that it was collected by a very old high noble at the court of France. And that's how it came into the Library of the King, now the National Library of France. So the Digital Critical Edition will make openly accessible this remarkable manuscript for the first time. It will be very, very useful to all kinds of scholars, to artists, to, I think the general public will be interested in how to train a dog in the late 16th century, for example.
Oh, it covers that.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
I thought it was just
Hold a piece of cheese under your armpit.
Really?
Yes, really.
Well, I'll try that with my miniature long-haired dachshund. I thought it was all craft and artisanal based, but it is more than that. Then.
Practice, so. Practical knowledge. Practical, I mean, how to train a dog is also practical knowledge.
So but have your students been taking these recipes and creating examples of the work?
And that's been one of the most wonderful parts of the whole thing. It's been a huge collaborative endeavor. The entire transcription and translation were grad-sourced, as we call it, crowdsourced by graduate students learning to read Middle French handwriting as they transcribed and translated the manuscript. We had 5 paleography workshops, and then each semester for the last 5 years, we have taught a course called Craft and Science, in which graduate students actually recreated the processes. First, they had to figure out what the processes were and then try to find instances of them in museum objects. And then they recreated those processes and those objects. So we have a lab full of fascinating 16th century art objects.
And beyond these objects, and we'll share some of the photos in the show notes, but they range from creating insects.
Yes, life casting. That was something that was of great interest at the time. Also creating hybrid animals. So we have in the lab rats with wings. That was one of the recipes in the manuscript. And why those objects? Why trying to preserve an ephemeral object in, you know, of a butterfly or a flower or a lizard in metal, life casting. Why do that? Why create these hybrid objects? Because at that time, people were very, very interested in the relationship of the human hand to nature. That is the potential of the artifice of the human hand in competition, in imitation of the artifice of nature. How did the human hand imitate nature? How did the human hand maybe surpass nature? That was an area of great interest, concern, and people collected these objects, which really led to, generated conversations on that topic. Mm-hmm. So hybrid objects, ephemeral objects preserved in metal, flowers preserved for the whole year, beautifully colored. All of those things spoke to the human capacity in its engagement with nature. And that's one of the most enduring kinds of things, I think. That was a period, the 16th century, where it was of incredible interest. Mm-hmm. Today is, in many ways, the same.
I suppose as well, alongside what was happening and things like the upheaval of old religious orders and the Reformation, it's people, individuals, believing that our individuality and our agency can have impact on the world, and that we're not just God's creatures, that we can actually... Maybe there was a sense emerging at that time that we weren't just focused on the world beyond us, as I think you said earlier, but actually focusing on how can we engineer the world to be in our...
How can human beings have, you know, what are the capacities of human beings? Mm-hmm. That was certainly a question that was being asked at that time. However, one of the answers, I have to say in that regard, that one of the answers was that we should focus on the world because that is God's first creation. Mm-hmm. And that by focusing on the world in that way, we will solve these terrible rifts that were happening in Christianity.
Mm-hmm. So now that you're launching the Digital Critical Edition and all the essays, how can, whether it be teachers and parents, embrace this and use this as an educational tool or even as a practical tool to improve making and knowing?
So one of the aims of this whole exercise of publishing this incredible manuscript that talks about how to make things is to try to encourage that kind of maker sensibility, not so much the maker sensibility of the digital printer, for example, but rather the actual working with the hands, because I do think that that is an area where that could use a lot of support. If I think, especially in the United States, of the state of the skilled trades and our educational system with regards to the skilled trades in this country, it really needs support. And I think we need to get back to some of those principles that were in force maybe in the 60s in many states in the United States of having woodshop and art classes and those kinds of activities, which have to a certain extent fallen by the wayside in the testing regime culture. So the Digital Critical Edition has all of these ways of doing things. So encouraging this kind of how-to sensibility and making and valuing handwork. I think that I would like to think that out of projects like this that are focused on what is craft knowledge, and there are other examples of writers who have written about the value of craft knowledge, for example, but out of this moment, which maybe is also generated by maker culture and the maker movement, that we will come to embrace or look for a new model of economic
sustainability
that well not just sustainability but really that can include skilled handwork,
because I know you've talked heard you talk in the past about Indian handloom weavers.
Yeah, okay.
And we're obviously, there's a lot of discussion, and I mentioned mm-hmm. Davos last week about beyond capitalism mm-hmm. and that we have to think beyond the standard bottom line mm-hmm. and that we can't, I mean, clearly in the world we're entering into the next 7 to 10 years around the environment, we can't sustain the growth at level and the population levels we've got. We have to almost mine the past and go back and understand how can we create, one, materials that might not be damaging to the planet, economic models that are more respectful of the planet, and that create societies and communities more bound together in their craft than a globalized society driven by outsourced and soon to be outmoded economic models. Could you maybe just reflect on that and maybe just mention a bit about the Indian handloomers, because I think it's an interesting story.
So I think that there are ways that we can think about how the significance that craft and handwork has in the modern world. And this really came home to me when I got to know handloom activists in India. There are a really sizable number of handloom, highly skilled handloom weavers in India. They produce quite a lot of the textile output of a country that textiles is a very large percentage of their GDP. And I realized that here is a long existing craft, still part of the economy, and it has very interesting roots, which I could go into, but I won't right now. But, you know, here is an activity. People are highly skilled. They're very proud of their work. It's a sense of real dignified labor if they could just make a living at it. And that's what I would like to see, really, is a valuing of that kind of labor and a new model of the economy that would make possible that kind of dignified labor, that being taken as a value. So that's one way in which I can see craft as having a place in a new model of the economy. And I think it's not just India. I think that there are a lot of people, say, in who have gone to Detroit because it has possibilities of living differently. So that's one way. I also think, just in terms of sustainability in agriculture in particular, that there were many, many methods in the past that would allow us to pursue a more sustainable agriculture. I mean, monocropping and the kinds of pesticides that it necessitates, I'm not an expert in this, but there are certainly models from the past that we could draw on in terms of more sustainable ways of going about agriculture. Now, of course, the elephant in the room, of course, is capitalism. So, and industrial agriculture, it's a very hard problem. Mm-hmm. So I think that those handloom activists in India and the sort of handcraft activists, more than handloom, there are many more handcrafts that are still alive or barely alive in India. And there are intellectuals in India and advocates in India who are really trying to figure out this new economy. Mm. But within the model of development, industrial development, which holds sway, it's pretty impossible to get taken seriously. And that's what I would really like to see happen, is that economists in the United States begin to take this seriously and begin to think about the position, what is work to human identity?
I mean, I was saying to another guest the other day that if Adam Smith and John Maynard Keynes were alive today, they wouldn't be just espousing their theories on economic models that were written three centuries ago. They would be looking at today's world and saying, what's the economic solution for a world that's clearly broken? And that's what we need to find. We need to find these leading economic thinkers. So
who are really responding to a world that's broken. Yeah.
Maybe they're in the halls of this great institution.
Well, there are some possibilities, but I don't think they've thought of craft as an answer. And that's what I would really like to get.
I don't think it can be done in isolation. Everything has to be,
that's true.
I think it has to be a practical theory rather than just a pure economic theory. So they
very
have
much
to be bound together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that economics as a discipline is changing. I mean, there is such a thing now called behavioral and experimental economics.
Yeah.
And that's a huge, for me, step forward. It's not simply an abstract science.
Yeah, so it's exciting. I'm conscious of time.
Yes.
I'm just going to quickly ask you serendipity. About serendipity, what chances or chance encounters, happy accidents, or serendipitous events have occurred that defined the direction of your journey?
Certainly taking history of science at the University of Wollongong is one serendipitous.
It's a pretty big one.
Yeah, it's a big one for my trajectory.
Could even go further back and say your father's decision to take a two-year
sojourn
in Wollongong.
Well, that's the thing, is it looks so ill-advised if you had stepped back, but who knows?
Yeah, okay. I was going to ask you about curiosity and creativity, but I think you're clearly a very curious and creative person, and it's a core of what you're doing, so we don't need to cover that. If you were given the keys to the White House to change something in relation to the education system, to improve the future opportunities of the youth today, what would you change?
As I said, the skilled trades, they need a lot of support in this country.
Yeah.
I think that creativity only comes out of diversity. I think that creativity only comes out of this incredible melting pot that the United States has been, and that is essential to continue. I mean, we need that kind of diversity. We need to, as we have, but need to do even more now, we need to celebrate that diversity. We need to celebrate that melting pot.
Great answer. Quick for our questions. What principles do you stand by?
Certainly persistence. persistence, hard work.
I'll definitely back you up on those.
Yeah.
What hard choices have you had to make that might have been tough at the time but did turn out to have been the right decision?
I think in some ways to go to graduate school to start this whole adventure. I really had little idea of what I was getting into. And then when I arrived, it was quite a shock, as it is for many students. I mean, I see them every day and it's a hard road. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. You get to be a student for your whole life. But that means the more you know, the less you're sure of. And that's a pretty vulnerable position to be in. And that's the way most academics, I think, feel, is the more they know, the less they actually know. But that's a good position.
But I think it's a great position.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly keeps you humble. Mm-hmm. And that's
thirsty.
A good thing. And thirsty.
And curious.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, we like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you go to when you need space to think?
Well, definitely I go into my work. I read a book, I do some more research, but I really like being outdoors. I really do a lot of thinking when I'm jogging or when I'm walking.
Okay. We added a new question, and you can skip it if you want, but if something comes to mind, just say it. What's the one problem worth solving?
I've got to say sustainability. I've got to say climate change.
Okay. What's your perspective on failure?
I hate failure myself. I mean, one always hates to fail or fail publicly, but I think it's such a useful experience. We fail, we go on, we learn how to do it better, we learn how to do it differently. So if there were one thing that I could change among my graduate students, I would love if they felt bold, if they felt like they could be bold. And I'll just give you one example, which is that in the lab course, in the craft and science lab course, in which they do all of this reconstruction of 16th century recipes, technical recipes, they have to learn how to separate eggs. And many of them have had no experience of separating eggs. They don't seem to do very much cooking, but in any case. And so they are afraid to start. They're afraid to bake that egg. And I would love it if they just tried it. Huh. And so they're afraid of failure. Wow. And just afraid of breaking an egg.
It came up in a conversation, I can't remember if it was an interview, but I think one of the things that should be embraced by all employers is a universal standard for resumes or bios or CVs, which has a new section on it, which talks about what you've learned from your failures.
That's great, yeah.
And if we did that, that would start to encourage people to fail.
Well, I have to say that we always ask candidates, for office positions and so on, staff positions, what have been challenges and how have you overcome them?
Yeah.
So it's sort of the same. But yes, I do think as a line on a CV, it's an interesting point.
How do you keep up with technology?
I ask my kids or my students.
Okay, that's a good one. Who has made you reevaluate yourself?
Certainly my children, certainly my students.
Yeah.
Yeah, every day. It's great to be in education in that regard. Keeps you young, or at least, or maybe it just makes you feel very old all the time.
What would your advice be to someone just about to graduate and sort of some of your students that might have a dream, a grand ambition, but have been told, don't go there, it's impossible?
Hold on to it. You don't really know what's impossible. I mean, just hold on to it.
Okay.
Just hold on to your passion.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, I have no idea.
That's all right. What's a recent best Netflix or Amazon series, or Apple series, I should say now, that they've launched their channel, or Disney?
And so
the list goes on.
I have no time to watch series, but I have to say, I do watch some. I love documentaries,
okay,
of course.
What documentary?
But yeah, but I Bryan Stevenson's Equal Justice. Oh. Everybody should watch it. Everybody should go to the museum, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, otherwise known as the Lynching Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama.
And this is Netflix?
I think so.
Final question. Who should we interview next?
A handloom activist from Hyderabad, Uzrama. She is an incredibly interesting creative, trained as a goldsmith. She is really trying to figure out the problem of how to make handloom weaving sustainable and economically viable.
Okay, we might not get to Hyderabad, so is there anyone else? Because we tend to do them face-to-face.
So another just absolutely wonderful artist is Elizabeth King, a sculptor. Her last exhibition, I believe, was Radical Small at Mass MoCA.
Oh, we like that place. We could go up there.
Just a wonderful... Well, she's in Richmond, Virginia. She's just a wonderful person. A film was made about her by Olivia Stone. Really lovely, lovely movie.
Okay. We'll follow up on that one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review because it helps more people find us. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player to listen and subscribe. This show is an Impossible Network production and is produced by Bettina McKaylee and Elaine Castillo-Keller. But for now, be curious, be creative, and seek out serendipity. See you next time.